This is July 29th, 2012, and I'm going to attempt to talk about excellence today. This topic sort of seeped into me over this past week and weekend. First of all, because of the expertise that we saw demonstrated here this weekend in our first annual, I'll go ahead and say it, first annual Sanghapalooza. For those of you listening to this as a recorded talk, this is where we just threw a bunch of experts together and offered little lectures or little courses, demonstrations this weekend on various things, on drawing and cooking and painting and yoga and qigong and mindfulness in medicine and music, free form, jam sessions and music. And I came to appreciate all over again how many people in the Sangha have really reached a not just proficiency in things, but a real degree of excellence. And at the same time, the Summer Olympics began this weekend, and that also got me to think about mastery and such things. And of course, practice and the two elements that go into expertise in Zen practice or any practice, any discipline, any field. The risk of oversimplifying, these two are effort and the ease that comes from effort. And I just want to explore the interplay between these two. We could even put it in broader terms, in terms of the conscious mind, the conscious body-mind, and what is beyond the conscious body-mind. So let's start with the obvious, the conscious side of things, where we have an aspiration, a goal, that we want to learn something and get better at it. And anyone, any adult knows that that requires effort, it requires discipline, requires practice. And in most of these things, it begins with learning technique. In Zen practice, it begins by learning how to sit. A lot of our ability to do Zazen effectively comes from just arranging the body in the proper way. And that's really the heart of our introductory workshops, is the posture demonstration, how to find a stable, relaxed, erect posture. And that involves some learning, some trial and error, learning of the method, the technique, the physical technique, the different postures we can try. All of this is by way of creating a container for what? For what is beyond all such conscious efforts, beyond form, the form of it. So we work with the body-mind the same way a great athlete will do. They start with tuning and disciplining and working on the structure that they have to work with. The body, but always when I say body, I mean body-mind. You cannot separate them. This is what in Chinese Zen is sometimes called the cultivation. Cultivation is another word for practice. It's cultivating the garden, getting the weeds out, preparing the soil, doing all the preparatory things. But it's not just preparatory. It's not just beginner stuff. It is an ongoing thing, which is really the essence of mastery is making it an integral part of your life forever. That's not what many of us want to hear when we begin Zen practice or when we begin set about learning how to do anything that requires learning. We sort of want to have it all right away. We know that there's some kind of learning involved and discipline, but we soon enough find out that, I'll just speak in terms of Zen practice, that it's not, if it's going to change us in a basic way, and more than that, if we're going to maintain the changes that we realize through practice, it has to be an ongoing thing. We can't just get in and out. Roshi Kapo admitted later, after he had left Japan and come back here, that he just wanted to grab Kensho and run. This is natural, of course, because as human beings, we don't like the effort. We want the results, we want the rewards, but without a lot of sacrifice. But of course, it takes sacrifice. So consciously, we set about to develop an ability, a talent, and that requires not only learning technique, posture, body-mind control, but also mindfulness. It's becoming aware of how we are handling ourselves. In the case of an athlete, the whatever the stroke or the swing or the step, and it requires perseverance. A lot of it. What's that old thing? It's 90. Success involves 90% perspiration and 10% inspiration. It requires will, of course. I will stick with this through thick and thin. This is all on the side of making progress, developing ourselves, whether as an athlete or an artist or a Zen practitioner. It's movement, it's change. We're learning forms, the various forms or mechanics. Why? So they can be forgotten. So we can get beyond careful mindfulness of technique and forms, and get into this other realm, which is the realm of the non-conscious, what's beyond our conscious efforts at self-control and perseverance and even mindfulness, beyond mindfulness. Mindfulness, the way I'm using it, it could be, I suppose, used in different ways, but mindfulness in terms of noticing how we're doing things, noticing our technique, the observer. What is beyond our conscious efforts at self-control and practice and perseverance and discipline and so forth. This is really the payoff. It's the realm of release, the realm in which we have developed enough proficiency in any discipline or practice that we can allow ourselves to let go. We can allow ourselves to relax. To reach this state now is widely known as flow, or to get into the zone. In Zen practice, we call this samadhi. It takes a lot of discipline to be able to reach a samadhi. A samadhi is just a state of absolute oneness. Speaking technically, the oneness, the merging or fusion or oneness of the subject and object, of I as the one who's doing the meditation, and the breath or the mu or whatever our particular practice is, to no longer experience the breath or the koan as an object apart from us. This is a very, maybe not very rare, it's a rare state to get into a true samadhi. And the irony is that it takes so much effort, so much conscious effort and will and perseverance and self-control and discipline in order to let go. To get into this state of freedom that is arguably what every human being wants to reach. A state of oneness, of self-forgetfulness. It's so ironic. It requires so much effort. And anyone who's been to Sesshin knows this. And if you haven't been to Sesshin, effort then can also translate as time. Years in order to have acquired enough proficiency in body, mind, self-control, and learning how to work, consciously work, so that we can get beyond all that. So that we can really get out of our own way. This is what might distinguish, what we might call no-mindedness, as distinguished from mindfulness. Mindfulness is more of a carefulness. No-mindedness is what we more talk about in Zen, is where we can trust the controlling self, the ego, if you will. We can trust. That we have gotten the form down enough that we can relax into this, what is beyond the form, beyond the observer or the kibitzer, this is where effort becomes effortless. This is the art of practice. I've been asked so many times. Understandably, I've been asked so many times about how to find how much effort to make in sitting, how much to impose one's effort, one's will, and how much to surrender. And of course, there is no way to articulate this in words in any precise way. And luckily, there's no need to, because if we persevere at this practice long enough, we will find our way into that balance between effort and surrender. That's where the magic is, isn't it? But I don't know, I can't say with any authority that such expertise always comes from, always is preceded by years and years and years of diligent work and self-discipline. I'm sure it usually does. There are those rare Mozarts who come into this life and can manage to effortlessly express genius, but they're really the exception to the rule, aren't they? They have to be. And for anyone who can buy the teaching of rebirth, I would submit that Mozart has made a hell of a lot of effort. And yes, practice, practice, practice. How do you get to Carnegie Hall? Practice in previous lifetimes. But we don't have to go there. It's just extraordinarily rare that such mastery, such excellence is not preceded by a great deal of effort. So just to draw from some things this weekend, I wasn't able to attend everything that was offered this weekend, or even half of what was offered. But we see evidence in the demonstrations and the teaching sessions that we were privileged to have this weekend at Sanghapalooza. We see the evidence of a great deal of this self-discipline and effort and mindfulness and perseverance. Right down the hall here, we have this magnificent giant Enso, the calligraphic circle that is said to be the only symbol in Zen. Zen, we don't deal much with symbols, we deal with direct experience. We want to reach that direct experience throughout our life. But the one symbol for sure, maybe there's a second or a third, but the only one I can think of right now is the circle, or what we call the Enso, as an expression of the closest thing we can find as a symbol, the closest thing to point to perfection, the perfection of our true nature. I had the privilege of seeing that big Enso at the end of the hall here, painted. Gretchen came to me, I asked her to do it, and she waited till we were both out here, this is years ago of course, and asked me lightly if I wanted to see her do it. Of course, yes. And then brandishing her mop, her floor mop, and her pail of ink, I watched in amazement as she just swept the mop around. I would estimate it took about 7 seconds, maybe 8 seconds tops, and it was done. But we know it didn't just take 8 seconds. It took 8 years, or 18 years, or 30 years of practicing that craft. Saw it yesterday with Steve Carpenter's talk and demonstration of drawing. The fluidity, the sureness of his presentation. The art of it. I'm sure when Jay Thompson, with his cooking demonstration, showed the same kind of fluidity and ease. I've certainly seen him at work in the Zen Center kitchen, so I can be sure that he was that same kind of form. Phil Swanson doing his magnificent music with decades of practice and work behind it to make it look effortless to the rest of us. Jim Thompson, Jennifer Burns, Elizabeth McMahon, Dave Sargent. Sports, the fine arts, music, acting. Acting is one of the few arts I've ever had a stab at. I used to enjoy doing it in school once during the summer. What I found was that it demands such enormous concentration to be able to lose yourself in the role while not forgetting the lines and the actions, the movements on stage, and without forgetting the others on stage with you. It is a magnificent practice in mindfulness and no-mindedness. It gets all mixed up. You have to start by learning the lines. You can't let go into the role and be really free and inhabit the role without learning the lines. And that takes work. And then rehearsals. Work, repetition, practice. And only then can we lose ourselves in it, and without abandoning the structure, the limitations, the lines and everything else. In so many things, we start off awkwardly, in the stage of learning, trying to assimilate what we need to know, whether it's driving a car, speaking a foreign language, riding a bike, parenting, I suppose. I wouldn't know through direct experience, but I did have some involvement in my sister's raising of their kids, and could see how in the beginning it can be so difficult, and one can be so unsure of oneself, and then through time, you incorporate it, you get better at it, and you relax, and no doubt do a better job. Teaching, same thing. Practicing medicine, psychotherapy. Going to Doksan. That's a thing that gives a lot of us trouble at first. We're so self-conscious, afraid of how we appear. Relaxing into going to Doksan begins with learning the procedures. This is why we take time with people, beginners, to make sure they're clear about how you do the bows, you know, how you close the doors, where you do the bows, how you do them. Why? For the same reason that we want to impart to beginners all the other procedures in the Zendo and everything else, with the chanting and the prostrations and everything, so that you can forget about the form. You can forget about how to do it and just do it no-mindedly rather than carefully or self-consciously. So it takes, I think most of us, a lot of doksans to be able to relax and open up and forget about how we're doing things or whether we're doing them right or wrong, and so forth. That's the last thing I want anyone to concern themselves with in Doksan, but my saying that doesn't matter. One will always worry about that coming in. Bobby McFerrin, the singer, said something about improvising, musical improvisation, that I wonder if our musicians have read, but I'm going to read it because it reminds me of going to Doksan. He was once asked, "You are known for your improvised solo concerts. Can you explain how that works, the process of musical improvisation?" And this was his answer. "The process is very easy to explain. Improvisation is basically motion. You simply sing one note and then another note. Or you play one note and then you follow it with another. Even if it's rambling and you don't know what you're doing, you're still improvising because you don't really need a lot of musical knowledge. I'm not even sure if you need any at all, because anybody can physically move their fingers on the keyboard or the violin or the flute or whatever they're playing. Singers can open up their mouths and just sing one note after another. That's the motion of improvisation. And the true virtuosos who really do it well are the ones who sort of face the fear of the unknown and are constantly making themselves move into it without really seeing what the next step is going to be. Now, that's the hardest part of improv, getting over the fear of doing it." There's a book on mastery that someone once lent me, and talks about in one section of the book, the middle section of the book, he says the five keys to mastery, and I won't mention all of them because they don't all apply to practice, and they're not quite equivalent, but some of them are. The first one is instruction, finding a teacher or instructor, coach. And I'm going to just skip that and make another Taisho out of it someday. But the matter of practice, this is the second of what he called the author is, who's the author of that mastery, George Leonard or no? Anyone? Come on, throw me a bone here. all right. We don't have to know. The second key to mastery is practice, and he makes the point that masters of any discipline or sport or music or other love to practice. They have settled into their practice or their craft as a treasured part of their life. I would say, in terms of Zazen, a refuge. Zazen becomes a refuge if you can get through the difficulty of finding your way and getting your posture settled. It becomes a refuge, truly wonderful refuge. And you know that this practice will still be there for you tomorrow, and it'll never go away. There's a saying in martial arts that the master is the one who stays on the mat 5 minutes longer every day than everyone else does. See the relationship, the intimate, causal connection between practice and mastery. You become, in fact, a master of practice. This can't be emphasized enough. And to stick with it like that, in the hot, humid weather and the cold times, and when you'd rather do this or do that, to stick with that, of course, requires faith. Faith in the method, in the practice. It means trusting the process. Not not getting involved in the particular particular ability or success on any given evening or morning, but trusting the taking the long view and trusting that if you stay with it long enough, that it will get easier, will get smoother, more fluid, and more rewarding. But that's where so many people fall to the side, is they just can't make themselves stick with it. Zen practice is absolutely guaranteed to transform you if you stick with it. Absolute guarantee. The benefits will just cascade upon you, unfolding month after month, year after year, if you stay with it. But it's not for everyone. Just to put it mildly, it's a very unusual person who has the initiative and the self-discipline, and yes, the faith, to stick with this practice. It's much easier to go to church and listen to the sermons and enjoy the socializing of the whole event than to cross one's legs or whatever posture one has and sit still without moving through the discomfort day in, day out, year out. So mastery, they say, really comes from just staying on the path. Along the path, this author says of the book called Mastery, along the path we're called upon also, to reach any kind of real excellence, much less mastery, we're called upon to be able to surrender, to let go of one's pride, basically, to go through certain indignities, as the author says. We have to get out of our comfort zone. So giving up certain putting up with some indignities while going back to going to one's first doksan or first few doksan requires certainly getting out of your comfort zone. It means giving up, he says, giving up our hard-won competence to go further, to go beyond our comfort zone. Because otherwise, we can settle into a kind of we can get stuck in the known and familiar. I heard that Tiger Woods, years ago, before he sort of had his implosion, ethical implosion, and when he was at the top of the golf world, even then, after having won many tournaments and being number one in the world, he decided that he needed to change his swing in order to go further, even further, and that he did. He stepped back and deconstructed, broke down his swing in order to build it back up. It takes, to imagine the self-confidence it takes to do that, and the faith in one's in the mastery still ahead of one. There's a saying I sometimes quote in Sesshin. Comes from the island of Crete. Leave where you have succeeded, return where you have failed. But if you're not complacent, if you're not willing to settle for something less than you're capable of, then it's not a great sacrifice to do this. Remember when I realized that there were other koan collections that Roshi Kaplow didn't work on, that, and therefore that I hadn't gotten from, worked on with him and Doksan, and I went to another teacher and another tradition, a peer, and just said, I don't know those koans. Would you be willing to teach me, to work with me on them? No, wait, excuse me, the first one, the teacher in the other tradition was going over, reviewing all the koans that I had worked on to see if there's something I'd missed. There might be other interpretations of the koans. It's one of the best things I ever did because it opened other doors. There weren't a great deal of differences in most of the koans. They were much the same, but there were a few differences that really opened my mind. And then to go with my own disciple, Sevan, when he had worked on other later koan collections, there was no pain in that. In sitting itself, in one's posture, sometimes I see even quite senior people, very senior people, with something in their posture that is going to be holding them back. It's something that will be blocking them from really relaxing completely into the practice. And that means maybe having a few months of sitting where you're self-conscious about the position of your head. You know, for most people, it's the position of the head. The head is too far forward, and to learn to pull the head back, tuck the chin in, can feel forced and strange. And what am I doing? I've been doing this for 20 years, and I have to still work on my posture. Well, those of real dedication will just go at it with hammer and tongs until they break that habit. Or sitting half lotus. This is something I had to do after about 20 years of sitting. I realized that my hips were, there was a little torque developing in my hips because I had always sat with the left leg on top of the right thigh. And so I just had to go through some months of sitting in sesshin and outside sesshin where instead I had to put the right leg on top of the left thigh, which was not as comfortable. It felt awkward. But as a result of this investment and swallowing one's pride, then there's the reward later on. There was once a little tiny article in the newspaper, one of these things you see from time to time, about a woman who had turned 100, and they asked her, well, what's the secret of your long life? And you saw a little photo of her there, what she replied was, just put your pride in your pocket and you'll have the world by the tail. One of the desert fathers, one of the Christian mystics, by the name of Amma Syncletica, said the following: in the beginning, there is struggle and a lot of work for those who come near to God. But after that, there is indescribable joy. It is just like building a fire. At first, it's smoky and your eyes water, but later you get the desired result. Thus, we ought to light divine fire in ourselves with tears and effort. There is a There's a book called The User Illusion that explores a fantastic book, long, dense, but just so illuminating. It's not a new book. Let's see the date. Came out in 1998, so that's 14 years ago now. And no doubt there's been further research. It's based on research about information theory and technology and the mind, the brain, and the body, and this interplay between conscious effort, the effort of the conscious mind, self-control and discipline, and what is beyond that. He starts a certain chapter by, let's see here, by talking about James Maxwell, a 19th century Scottish physicist, who he said summarized all that was known about electricity and magnetism in four short, elegant equations. And those were unifying, I don't know what the equations were. But on his deathbed, what he said was, what is done by what is called myself is, I feel, done by something greater than myself in me. Let me just reread that. What is done by what is called myself is, I feel, done by something greater than myself in me. This is what we're getting at methodically, systematically through Zen practice, is reaching that what is beyond the ordinary, our ordinary sense of ourself. He talks earlier in the book about this half-second delay between our response. This is just mind-blowing, but he presents research, very compelling research, that we can respond to a stimulus before we're consciously aware of it. And then he cites this example of in the world of soccer, getting back to Olympics, where a certain great soccer player, a guy who went on to become a great soccer player, Michael Laudrup, was playing in a big match against he played for Denmark against England. The match was not even a minute old. England had always been one of the world's great soccer teams. Denmark, no. And Laudrup got beyond the defenders, and all that was ahead of him was a ball, a lot of grass, and an open goal. He had veered toward the side, I'm reading here, he had veered toward the side of the goal area and was very close to the dead ball line on his way around the last defender, but the goal was empty. All he had to do was give the ball one last poke. I had plenty of time. I thought about what I should choose to do. I screwed up, Laudrup explained when he was asked if a player has time to be conscious of what he was doing when he does it. He missed. Laudrup, it says here, Laudrup had time to become conscious before he acted. The result was a miss that millions of TV viewers remember to this day. So he was asked later, can one be conscious of one's game while one plays it? And his very clear answer was, no. A number of advanced computations, the author here says, take place, but they are not conscious. Except, that is, in unique situations where there is time to think things over. And that's where things go wrong as a result. There are many instances like this and anecdotal about how the thinking mind can act like a stick in the spokes of our true nature, the free functioning of our true nature. Joe Montana, the great quarterback, one of the greatest of all time, also said in an interview that he's not conscious while he's playing. He's not conscious while he's playing. What is that territory, that gray area between conscious and it's not the unconscious. It's, I think a better word is the non-conscious, what is beyond the conscious. Later he says, the point is that it is not people's consciousness that begins the process, but something else unconscious. It is still myself who disposes, but it is not my I that has the power to dispose. It is me. Now, he uses a vocabulary here that I think can be confusing when you're just listening to this. He uses for the ego or the conscious self, he uses the word I, and for what is beyond the conscious self, he uses the word me. But I think it's just too difficult to keep those straight, and I'm just going to read a couple things and use the conscious, the terms the conscious mind and the non-conscious, so that is what is beyond the conscious mind. We must distinguish between the conscious and the non-conscious. I am not identical with the non-conscious. The non-conscious is more than my conscious. It is the non-conscious who decides when the conscious does not. The conscious is the conscious player. The non-conscious is the person in general. You could say our true self, maybe. The conscious is not at the wheel in many situations. When urgency is required, for example, the conscious mind is in charge of lots and lots of situations where there is time for thought, but there is not always time. The term non-conscious, or let's say our true self, embraces the subject of all the bodily actions and mental processes that are not initiated or carried out by the conscious mind. Okay. And then he goes on to say that man is primarily non-conscious. This is being developed more recently. This has been developed by David Brooks and others. There's much more research now that supports this, that we are basically, we function in a non-conscious way, that the conscious mind, that is the controlling mind, is not very useful to us. The idea of a conscious mind as a conscious self as housekeeper of everything that comes in and goes out of one is an illusion. Perhaps a useful one, but still an illusion. Hence the title of the book, The User Illusion. Now this is where we get to the gist of all this. The experience of free will is linked to situations where the non-conscious, that's as I say, true mind, our true self, dares to allow the self to make the decision. When more speed is required, the conscious self and its free will are suspended. The true self simply reacts. The conscious mind experiences free will when the true self lets it. We long for this experience of the now. We spend much of our spare time pursuing it in sports, dancing, playing games, intense conversation, sex, and intoxication. In other words, we want to suspend this kibitzing, observing ego self in order to allow our true self to live to the full. We call it art, performance, or first class athletics. And he goes on to say that all performers are plagued more or less by an apparent paradox, shame at success. This is wonderful. This is a curious but very real phenomenon. Performers find it hard to accept applause. Some even want to abolish it completely. The great pianist Glenn Gould wrote an essay in 1962 entitled "Abolish Applause." It quotes an author of a book called Inside Music, in which the author Peter Bastian explained his own difficulties in accepting applause. It is hard to have the courage to tell yourself you are good. Sure, people clapped when I played, but deep down inside I thought I was bluffing. But then he came around and he formulated the attitude that allowed him to accept their applause. I acknowledge that I have been putting myself to great effort. I acknowledge that I have practiced myself. So this shame, he says, comes because it was not the conscious mind, the ego, that gave the performance, but our true self, where we could let go of our controlling tendencies. But it's the conscious self, it's the ego that gets all the credit. Last night, I attended the performance of this film produced and put together by two of the several people, or Sangha members, Andy Stern and Tom McGrain. Tom McGrain is a sculptor who sculpted five animals to memorialize the five birds that have become extinct as a way of memorializing them. And there too, in this marvelous movie, and it is really marvelous. It's just an hour long, but it's so inspiring. You see the artist at work. You see someone who had the courage to let go of his conscious planning and just let his hands form these sculptures. And then beyond that, with Andy, the two of them just groping their way to find places to place these five sculptures, and the process that went through that is so much beyond the conscious control of them. And then the editing of this, they said in a panel discussion after the film that the cinematographer took 150 to 200 hours. He shot 150 to 200 hours, and then the editor had to boil it down to 1 hour. And what a Herculean job that must have been to weed all that out. And there, too, you can be sure this is someone, an expert, someone with a lot of experience who was able to do that so artfully. And that's what this all really comes down to, is experience. Zen is the school of direct experience. It just takes time. It takes experience to work our way into even just proficiency, much less true excellence, or much less mastery. Our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.